loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, as the government's partial shutdown nears the third week, we discuss Donald Trump's upcoming primetime address to the nation, where some expect him to declare a national emergency in order to construct a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. And then we continue our weekly series called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, news broke today that prosecutors in New York charged Russian lawyer Natalia Veselnitskaya with obstruction of justice. But a closer look at the indictment reveals that U.S. authorities charged her essentially for corresponding with Russian prosecutors to advocate for her client, the corporation Prevazon. Nevertheless, the indictment is now being cited as evidence that Veselnitskaya is an agent of the Russian government and was acting as such when she participated in the June 2016 Trump Tower meeting prior to the election. Next, today we begin our new regular segment, which we'll do every Tuesday, called Women and Society with Dr. Hannah Dickinson. In this weekly segment, we talk about the major issues, challenges, and struggles facing women in all aspects of society. Then, U.S.-China trade talks showed signs of progress today with President Trump tweeting optimistically that a deal is likely. Tariffs on $200 billion of Chinese imports are set to jump from 10% to 25% on March 2nd if there's no deal. Meanwhile, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is in Beijing for talks with Chinese Premier Xi Jinping for the fourth time since assuming power. And then, Turkish President Erdogan issued a blunt put-down of National Security Advisor John Bolton yesterday over his pledge to ensure Turkish non-aggression against Syrian Kurdish forces, saying, "We cannot accept Bolton's messages given from Israel," and adding, "Bolton has made a serious mistake." Bolton was in Turkey yesterday, but Erdogan refused to meet him. And finally, the French government will take new measures as it seeks to corral the Yellow Vest movement after another weekend of mass protests. More than 50,000 people demonstrated over the weekend, and the Macron government is taking full advantage of the opportunity to clamp down on dissent. And in other headlines, Donald Trump convened top advisors today for a meeting to discuss pharmaceutical drug prices. Despite exhortations from Trump to keep prices low, pharmaceutical companies have continued to raise prices. The meeting today involved Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar, Chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers Kevin Hassett, and Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney. Calm has returned to Gabon after a coup attempt staged by members of the country's armed forces was put down. Two suspected coup participants were killed and eight arrested. Gabon has been ruled by current President Ali Bongo since 2009, when he took over from his father, who had led the country since 1967. The union representing TSA screeners said that many employees have quit as a consequence of the government shutdown, and others are considering doing so if their next paycheck is not sent. Essential TSA employees have been working without pay since the shutdown began. TSA screeners are among the lower-paid federal employees and often have to live paycheck to paycheck. A vote by the UK Parliament on Brexit has been rescheduled for January 15th. After many delays and much debate, the British members of Parliament will have the chance to weigh in on Prime Minister Theresa May's deal with the European Union. The Parliament will hold 5 days of debate on the Brexit deal starting tomorrow. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to President Trump's border wall. The president is considering declaring a national state of emergency as a way to obtain funding for his border wall. With the partial government shutdown nearing its third week and no end in sight, Trump says he's willing to take the unusual action. Immigrant rights advocates, on the other hand, say that there is absolutely no reasonable argument that the situation on the U.S.-Mexico border constitutes a national crisis. Will the Trump administration get away with this massive expansion of executive authority? We're joined from Seattle by Jorge Barron, the executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. And later, we'll be joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer who's the author of the new book, The Plot to Control the World: How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. Welcome, Jorge.
Thank you for having me on.
Jorge, so Vice President Pence this morning said that President Trump has not made up his mind whether or not he wants to declare a state of emergency. MSNBC reported today that undocumented crossings of the border are at their lowest level since 1972. So how does he get away with, both politically and legally, a declaration of a national emergency in order to build this wall?
Well, you know, I think the president, unfortunately, one of the things that we've seen is that the president continues to say things that are just simply not true. And unfortunately, he's been able to get away with some of these things. And I think the question is whether the country is going to start pushing back. I mean, I think we saw in the election that they have already rejected, voters have already rejected some of his policies. But you know, they still control the presidency and the Senate. And so this is just another attempt at trying to use, you know, falsehoods to pursue policy. We saw it, you know, from the very beginning with things like the Muslim ban, and this is just another attempt at using this cry of national security to manufacture something that's not actually happening.
You know, and politically, it's as though opponents of this wall are speaking into a vacuum. And I think a part of it is that the president is really addressing his base. Why he's not trying to expand to a broader audience is a mystery to me. But his base really believes that there is a crisis on the border.
Well, and the problem is that the president has created, if there is any kind of crisis, right, it's certainly not a national emergency, but I would say there is a crisis that the president himself and his administration have created, and it's a humanitarian crisis, right, of the people at the southern border who are seeking asylum. I mean, this is not the same type of issue that we had in the 1990s and the 2000s, where there was more economic migration coming, and there was the numbers, as you mentioned, were much higher. The fact is that the crossings are reduced, but also the crossings that are happening are people who are trying to turn themselves in and seek protection here in the U.S., primarily from the Northern Triangle countries. And so the problem is that the president has created this humanitarian crisis, and now he's using sort of those images and that sense that there is a problem at the border, but you know, conflating it with you know, terrorism and drug trafficking, which are not going to be addressed by the border wall, first of all, and are not as serious of an issue as the president is claiming, and that's been, you know, refuted by the statistics of their own administration. You know, these claims that Sarah Sanders made, I think over the weekend, of the fact that there are thousands of terrorists coming across the border, when the State Department has conclusively said that there's no evidence of anybody who is an actual terrorist coming across the southern border.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. She said that there were between 3,000 and 4,000 terrorists or terror suspects who had been stopped at the southern border. That just simply wasn't true. There were, I think it was six in the first half of the last fiscal year. There were 41 stopped coming over the Canadian border. What she was talking about, that 3,000 to 4,000 number, was the number of people from a country that has produced a terrorist at some point, which is just crazy. And that talking point, that falsehood, is being repeated over and over. It was repeated all weekend on the talk shows, and then the vice president repeated it again this morning.
That's right. And it's important to note that even that six number, right, which is already, you know, far below the thousands that they were claiming, you know, it refers to people who are on terrorist or like watch lists, which have, you know, been shown as being, you know, very over inclusive. And so that's the disconnect, that not only had there been no like actual people prosecuted for terrorism who came across the southern border, but then, you know, even the number of six that has been confirmed is people, you know, who had their suspicions that may or may not have been founded. And so, yes, I mean, the arguments that they're making, you know, if there's a claim for a wall, you know, we should be building it on the northern border first, according to their arguments. Obviously, I don't think that's necessary in any way. And so I think this is just, you know, the president has sort of boxed himself in by claiming that he, you know, he wants this wall, when even folks who are, you know, usually very pro strong immigration enforcement mechanisms like the Center for Immigration Studies, you know, have also been saying like, well, this is not the most important thing in terms of immigration enforcement. And so I think, you know, this is just the president, you know, realizing that he's got to deliver on what he said, even though what he actually said was that, you know, Mexico would pay for the wall, of course.
That's right. I want to throw out a couple of statistics, too, that I think are important to this conversation. Number one, the Brennan Center issued a report on Friday saying that fully 58%, a majority, a clear majority of people who are in the country, I'm going to use the word illegally, are people who have overstayed their visas. Most of them are Canadians and Europeans. That's 58%. A wall is not going to do anything to keep those people out of the country or to get them out of the country as they're already here having overstayed their visas. That's number one. Number two, CNN published a chart this morning that I think is fascinating. And it's the number of national emergencies declared since Jimmy Carter was president. Now, Jimmy Carter was president in my memory practically yesterday. So 1976, right, 77 to 81. So since Jimmy Carter, there have been 31 national emergencies declared. Many of them are still active. For example, President Carter declared a state of emergency during the Iran hostage crisis, and that's never been rescinded. We're still in a state of emergency vis-a-vis Iran. Carter declared 2, Reagan 6, George H.W. Bush 4. Bill Clinton declared 17 states of emergency, of which 6 are still ongoing. George W. Bush, 12, of which 10 are still ongoing. Barack Obama, 13, of which 11 are still ongoing. So this isn't something new. This isn't a new concept. Presidents do this all the time, and usually people don't pay any attention to it. In this case, people are paying attention to it, but then the New York Times says that challenges to a president declaring a state of emergency have fared poorly in court, and that Donald Trump is probably within his rights to declare this emergency, even though no such emergency exists, and to draw this money from the Pentagon budget. How do you respond to that? Do you think there's any legal challenge here?
I do think that there's going to be a legal challenge, but I also agree with the sense that courts tend to be very deferential to the president, right? I mean, we saw that ultimately with the Supreme Court decision in the Muslim ban case, where ultimately the Supreme Court said, well, we don't want to second guess what the president is saying when it comes to national security, and I think it's problematic because I think the problem then is that becomes sort of this magic phrase, right? That if the president says, like, well, I need to do this because of national security, then anything goes. And I think that's a really problematic, problem for the country when you have that situation. I mean, imagine if President Obama had declared, and I think he would have been a much more solid factual ground to say, as a matter of national security, I think climate change is a national security crisis, so I'm going to redirect, the military to build massive, solar panels. You can imagine the reaction would have been at the time. People would have said, like, this is overreach, et cetera. And now sort of Republicans in Congress are like, yeah, this might be what the president needs to do. So I think it's really problematic when you have, this declaration just be solely reliant on what the president says when there's no basis factually to really declare an emergency.
We're speaking with Jorge Barron from Seattle. He is the executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. Jorge, the president is going to give this speech, and the Democratic rebuttal will be given jointly by Speaker Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. The Democrats are going to lay out their position that they just simply are not going to appropriate money for this wall. The president is asking the Pentagon for, not asking, he will order the Pentagon apparently for $5 billion to pay for the wall. $5 billion isn't going to pay for the wall. It might pay for a few miles of the wall, but most of the experts, including engineers at MIT, say that this wall will cost between $25 and $33 billion. So what are we looking at here? Are we looking at just a political play, or do you think that there really will end up being a wall?
I think, unfortunately, I think there's, because I think, even some folks in the Democratic Party have been, swayed by this idea that we need to do, fencing or some barrier of some kind. I think, unfortunately, we're going to see some of that happen eventually. But I really hope that that's not what ends up happening. I hope that people will see that, you know, if we want to address the issue of forced migration, of the reason that people are leaving Central America, that what we need to work on is on the root causes and the responsibility that the U.S. government itself has and the U.S. has of the crisis that it has helped both foster and make worse in places like El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, and that we need, you know, if we want to reduce people having to flee those countries and come here, that we need to work on making the situation better there. And, you know, building a wall is not going to address that problem. So I hope that people will really fact check whatever the president is saying, because I think we're going to hear a lot of statements that are not true tonight, to say the least.
That was the voice of Jorge Barron, who has to leave us, unfortunately. He joined us from Seattle. He's the executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. And we're now joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer who's the author of the book, The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you, John.
Dan, Jorge and I were talking about the president giving this speech in which he may or may not announce that he is seeking emergency authorities to build this wall. Courts have ruled in the past that when presidents want to invoke emergency powers, they generally have the right to do that. Do you think the Democrats have any recourse?
Well, I suppose someone could try to go to the Supreme Court and allege that it is not within his constitutional powers to do this. I think that over the years, these executive orders have been increasingly abused by presidents. And I think this probably is a very good time to challenge the constitutionality of these types of orders. I mean, I just think it can't be the case that any time a president claims there's an emergency, that the president can basically do whatever he or she wants to do. You know, Congress under the U.S. Constitution has the power of the purse. And at this moment, they have denied Trump his request for the money out of the purse for the wall. It seems to me that there's a big problem with Trump then trying to do an end around the congressional powers to try to get the millions or billions he needs to build that wall in any case. So we shall see. But I think this may be the opportunity to cut back on executive power.
You know, you've hit really on the key here. The key is the money. The key is the appropriation. You can only steal so much money from the Pentagon to build your wall. You're not going to be able to build that entire wall just sucking money out of the Pentagon. I mentioned to Jorge Barron just a few minutes ago that engineers at MIT are estimating that this wall really is going to cost between $25 and $33 billion. Now, I don't have the figure in front of me, but anyway, up to $33 billion. The president says he wants $5 billion. That's not going to build a wall. And Congress still has the authority to control the appropriations process. It's constitutionally granted, as you say. I'm interested, too, in the quickness with which some presidents declare national emergencies. I had forgotten that Barack Obama declared a national emergency because of an outbreak of the swine flu about 5 years ago. But he actually did. And that is still an open issue. The power, the authority was never rescinded. I think this is something that people are afraid that President Trump will do. You declare a national emergency, you start taking money from the Pentagon budget to build the wall, and then you never declare the emergency over. So what do Democrats do? Do they go straight to the courts? Do they ask for this to be expedited up to the Supreme Court? Or is there something else that they can do internally vis-a-vis the budget?
Well, I think they could go to the Supreme Court directly. I think to challenge this type of conduct by the president, I believe the Supreme Court would have original jurisdiction over that, arguably.
Well, let me interrupt you on that. So how does that work, Dan? Instead of going to a federal district court, they just go directly to the Supreme Court?
There are some cases that you can do that raise this type of question of constitutional powers. I believe they could go directly to the Supreme Court. Although I see that unlikely, I mean, there's also a question of standing. That is, who has the injury here? You have to have a person who's injured to bring the claim. And Congress would claim, well, our power of the purse is being injured, so maybe they would have standing. But that would be a huge question here. I think there's little they could do internally about this because while the Democrats do have the majority in the House, they don't have it in the Senate. And so I think that they probably can't do much as a Congress without going to the Supreme Court to do anything about this.
You know, my guess is this is going to be bogged down in court, whether it's the Supreme Court or one of the lower courts, because according to the Brennan Center, there are 130 different laws that contain special powers that President Trump could access. 130 different laws that would allow him to circumvent the normal flow of business, the normal appropriations process, to take money either from the Pentagon or, it says here, from FEMA. We're talking about money for emergency housing, for example, money for storm reconstruction, money for military housing. This can all be moved over to build this wall.
Yes, I think, you know, you raise a good point that there probably are a lot of avenues through which Trump can find monies for this. On the other hand, again, the question is, can he get enough? Number one, and number two, will this be seen as such a brazen usurpation of congressional authority that it will be deemed unconstitutional? So we'll just have to see. I saw one opinion maker say that they believed what Trump would do is try to scrounge as much money as he could, put a few poles in the ground, at least start the wall until someone tells him to stop. You know, this is all about politics. And I think Trump feels to placate his base, he needs to do everything he can to at least try to build the wall and then blame the Democrats when he is unsuccessful.
Dan, there was a terrific op-ed in the New York Times over the weekend written by Bruce Ackerman, who's a law professor at Yale. He really laid this out, in my view, very clearly. I want to read a little bit of what he wrote. He said, "The president of the United States has a constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. It is unconstitutional for him to take care to violate the laws of the United States." He called the threat of a national emergency a profound crisis. And then it goes on to say, "Others have echoed Ackerman's declaration that Trump cannot lawfully declare a state of emergency for the wall. Fox News judicial analyst Judge Andrew Napolitano said in a Fox appearance on Monday that the president, quote, cannot spend money unless it's been authorized by Congress, period. And that's the position really of all constitutional scholars who have weighed in on this, that Congress has to appropriate the money." And it goes on to say, "Some have pointed to a Korean War era court case, Youngstown Sheet and Tube versus Sawyer, in which the Supreme Court ruled that President Harry Truman's attempt to nationalize U.S. steel mills during a strike during the Korean War was unconstitutional. If Harry Truman couldn't nationalize the steel industry during wartime, this president does not have the power to declare an emergency and build a multi-billion dollar wall on the border," said Congressman Adam Schiff. What do you think? You think that's a strong argument?
I don't know if the analogy really holds up, but I agree with the ultimate conclusion that I think, again, this is a sort of case that I think the courts will look askance at. So first of all, generally the courts will defer to the executive branch in terms of its declaring a state of emergency. But I think this may be the case where they'd say, we really don't see an emergency here. Well, you can't really make that out. Because, in fact, there have been some reports that even the Department of Homeland Security's own statistics show there is no emergency at the border. I mean, his own branch of government has concluded there's no emergency. So on that basis alone, it may be able to be stopped because the whole basis for what he's trying to do will be stopped. But again, I think also the question is, does he have the authority to use money in this way when Congress hasn't explicitly granted it to him? And I think that will be a big Achilles heel for this type of action.
We are speaking from Pittsburgh with Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer who's the author of the book, The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. Dan, I want to ask you about politics here, too. Let's say that the president does declare an emergency and does shuffle some Pentagon money around to begin building a section of wall. Does that take away then whatever impediment there is for passage of at least a continuing resolution to get the government back to work again? Or is this a deeper political crisis?
Well, I think no matter what happens, whether he tries to build the wall or not, they're going to obviously have to find a way to pass a budget. I mean, an emergency one or otherwise. I mean, we're getting to the point where it's going to become very, very dangerous not to have some sort of federal appropriation that is agreed to. You know, there's discussions that, you know, people aren't going to get tax returns, that the national parks are starting to look like the Wild West. I mean, there's just some things. And then not to mention, you know, employees, particularly low-paid federal employees, who are going to go weeks, if not months, without a paycheck. I mean, this is going to have to be resolved no matter what he does with that wall. And I would think it'll be resolved fairly shortly.
We've got about 2 minutes left, Dan. The president said this morning on Fox that federal workers with whom he has spoken have told him to keep up the fight, keep the government closed, that they're with him. That's preposterous. CNN, MSNBC, and others have had tearful interviews with government workers who are at risk of losing their homes. Do you think that there will be enough pressure on the president to finally go to the table with a realistic offer to end this shutdown? Or do you think that he really does only care about his base? He's accused federal workers of being all Democrats anyway.
Yeah, which isn't true. I mean, that's the problem here, that ultimately I think he's going to also see his base turn away from him. I mean, I think, you know, a short federal shutdown, you know, that's done over what he views to be a principled position, maybe that does something for his base. But the longer this goes on, and the longer, you know, the more it becomes clear that it's his fault, that there's not a budget, the more, you know, that his own base may turn away from him. And that is the danger here for him. So, yes, I do think in fairly short order, he will be forced to come to the bargaining table with Congress. By the way, I wanted to correct something in any case. I was looking very quickly through my legal books as we were talking. The Supreme Court does have original jurisdiction, but only between states, in litigation between states. So Congress could not go there directly. They would have to start out in the district court, but they could move there pretty quickly.
Oh, how interesting. Okay, so explain that. What happens? Let's say he tries to move these funds. The Democrats file a case in what, some random district court?
Probably the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia.
Uh-huh.
And again, I would see the district court making a pretty quick decision.
Does it have to go to circuit court?
Then it go to the circuit court, and then it would go to the Supreme Court. So, but again, on a case like this of such constitutional importance, I think it would go very quickly.
Okay, we'll leave it there. We were joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer who's the author of the book, The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. And we were joined from Seattle a little bit earlier by Jorge Barrón, the executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. This segment happens on Loud and Clear every Tuesday. We're joined from the San Francisco area by Daniel Sankey. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, what's new? What's new in the world of the economy? And I would say it's become the dominant news in the mainstream media, but let's start.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things I wanted to talk about was a recent report that came out about the so-called gig economy, which for those who might not be familiar, the gig economy is the economy that really Uber started to create, and then a whole bunch of other companies started to pile on, like TaskRabbit and Lyft and others. And it's really this pay-per-task economy, where Uber drivers get paid per ride, and then in between rides, they don't get paid at all. They have to use their own car, they have to pay for their own gas, etc. And it's this transformation of the economy. A report went out that basically said that this had shown that it was upending how Americans work, that basically the old sort of 9-to-5 model was no longer a thing and that it would be moving towards this new gig economy, which, you know, seemed to be a pretty reasonable estimate. What's interesting now, though, is that the economists have realized that a lot of their data that they looked at was actually inaccurate and that there were some wild inaccuracies, which I think to our listeners should seem pretty obvious, but to the economists weren't. First of all, they learned that when economies are weak, when the job market is poor, that there's this big upsurge in gig economy, which is not surprising. As people cobble together a living from a whole bunch of different jobs, they take whatever they can get and they try to make it work. But as the labor market tightens, as it has over the last 6-9 months or so, people stop doing those jobs as they get regular work. And as it turns out, the gig economy is a really terrible way to make a living and people would prefer not to do it. It seems like this should be pretty self-evident to anyone who's had to work the gig economy or knows anybody who has or is just paying attention. But this was not obvious to economists who then learned, oh, this gig economy isn't nearly as strong as we thought it was. So it turns out that as the job market tightens and wages go up a little bit, people are dropping these and taking on new jobs, which is important. More than that, though, what's really interesting and what the article points out is since 2005, when the Labor Department has repeatedly sought funding to start taking census data and researching the gig economy to get some solid facts and figures about how it's impacting American labor. So it's been trying to get this funding for quite some time, more than 15 years, and it has consistently been, or more than 10 years, excuse me, it has consistently been turned down for funding to study the gig economy, which I think is really interesting because it seems like as we're going through this potentially radical transformation of labor, this would be something that the Labor Department would want to know more about. And this is data also that other economists and companies can use to plan and forecast things, but it's been denied, which it doesn't obviously say why, and it doesn't go into it, but I kind of wonder if there aren't those who hold the purse strings that would really rather we not know too much about what goes on in the gig economy and how it works, that it might be best to sort of not put that under too much of a microscope, because I think if we did, we'd see what an exploitative and unpleasant way it is to make a living. So that's my guess. Of course, that's my speculation. It doesn't actually outright say that, but I think that that definitely holds. It's a terrible way to make a living.
Yeah, Daniel Senke is our guest. We talk to Daniel every week in this segment called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism. Daniel, how many people are in the gig economy?
Yeah, it goes on to estimate. It looks like several hundred thousand are potentially involved in it, if not more. But again, because the data was so poor, it was really hard for these economists to get it. So they actually had to run their own surveys of people and run their own reviews, which is harder to do because when you have a government agency behind you, you know, they can collect that data a lot more effectively. And in this case, they didn't. So they weren't totally sure. What we can say is that it's decreased significantly over the last 6 to 9 months as the economy strengthened. And different companies like Uber and Lyft are struggling to get more low-wage work. They're having to pay people more to attract them to this job, which, of course, eats into their profits. So they're unhappy. But basically, you know, the idea is if the labor market's weak, that means that you can really exploit workers. You can pay them a lot less. You can give them a lot less benefits. And we're seeing a brief momentary turnaround of that.
You know, one of the real fallacies about the gig economy is that it's presented as a form of freedom. Like if you don't have to, quote, go to work from 9 to 5, close quote, if you can choose, I'm going to work today and not work tomorrow, there's a certain kind of freedom.
Sure.
That's true. But the freedom isn't actually free because in exchange for your freedom, you don't have health care benefits. You don't have vacation. When you're sick, you don't have sick pay. You have no pension. You have nothing. And the freedom evaporates quickly because what really gives people freedom, meaning the freedom to live as they might want to, is to have sufficient resources so that if you are sick, you can go to a doctor. If there's an emergency, you have enough in the bank to cover it. Or that in what should be the case, people's housing is completely affordable. It is in some places. Or healthcare is free. It is in some places. Or young people can go to college for free, which it is in some places. All of these freedoms that the American worker has are really the freedom to live in want or to live with insecurity. I can remember when Air France was trying to rescind basically French Air France workers' pensions. And this was about 15, 20 years ago. And of course, the French working class has this very militant tradition, as we can see now with the Yellow Vest movement or the 1968 or the Paris Commune of 1871 or the French Revolution of 1848 or the French Revolution of 1789. You go through, there's a long tradition. And as a consequence, the French workers have a lot of economic and social rights that American workers don't have. And the thing that really jumped out at me about this particular protest by Air France workers was their banner, their slogan. Their slogan was, "A worker without a pension equals an American." And I thought it was like very, very, very clever, very funny, but very prescient, very apt.
Yes.
Go ahead, Daniel.
That's phenomenal. I'd never heard that. Yeah, I think there's what you talk about at the start was this idea of freedom, that you're free to work a job or not work a job. And really, that's classic neoclassical economics, which is an economic model that's dominant in the Wall Street space, dominant in the big bank financier corporate space. And it's this idea that workers figure out how much their time is worth, figure out how much they can get paid. And they say to themselves, I guess this week, it's worth 30 hours this week because that 10 extra hours I want to do, you know, playing baseball or something like that. And that we do this calculation where we say, how much is it worth? And if we choose not to work, because of course we're choosing not to work, it's because we've determined that our leisure time is worth more. This is, of course, crazy because the 99% of the population that has to work for a living does not get to sort of make this calculation and say, this month, I think I'll only do this much. We work to survive. We work to live. We work because without it, if I lost my job within a few months, my life would be radically transformed. I would go from a relatively comfortable life to total destitution, homelessness, and all the brutality that comes with it. So this idea of freedom is ridiculous. You know, we're free to get paid less. We're free to not have benefits. We're free to get paid a pittance by the likes of Uber and Lyft. So I think that's a really good idea. I mean, that's a really good example of that kind of misthinking that they use to somehow bake freedom into it. And also to comment, on the French workers' tradition, you know, this idea of pensions is still a major thing in Europe and still something that people fight for and about. And really, pensions technically exist in the United States, but they've been stripped back tremendously. And many workers have lost out on pensions. I remember when I worked for Wells Fargo, the pension program was discontinued while I was there. I just started to qualify for it. And the chief financial officer of Wells Fargo was fired because he was mismanaging funds, basically. He was investing employee funds in a company that he had a controlling interest in. And so he had to step away. And at the same time, they decided, let's just not do pensions at all. It just seems too complicated. And so we lost our pensions. This is, you know, very typical. So, I think that worker militancy is a big part of why they still enjoy their pensions and a lot of other social services besides that compared to U.S. workers is really much, much better.
Yeah. And, you know, this is the reality of this system. If you don't have a pension, but even if you do have a pension, in bankruptcy proceedings, those pensions can be wiped out. The executives, the CEOs, the board of directors, they can hand those pension liabilities over to the U.S. government, and the U.S. government has its own special pension guarantee fund, but those funds are limited. That happens all the time, and pensions are a big deal. They're worth a lot of money. I can remember vividly that my father, who worked at Eastman Kodak almost from the moment he got out of the U.S. Army at the end of World War II, all the way until he retired. He worked at Eastman Kodak as a chemist all of those decades. And he had a good pension, and Eastman Kodak was considered a very buoyant company. Where we grew up in Rochester, New York, it had 55,000 employees work for Kodak, and that was, you know, in a city of about 300,000 people. It was a company town with a lot of, you know, people wanted to work at Kodak because the pay was higher, good pension, et cetera, et cetera. But then when Kodak started to go down, and of course Kodak did go down, and those 55,000 workers in Rochester, New York were, you know, it was brought down to about 3,000 workers. And then suddenly Rochester became a murder capital and crime and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Well, Kodak could just, you know, declare bankruptcy and end that pension program, which is what happened to him, to my father. That happens to workers all over the country. Even when you're guaranteed a pension, under this current economic order, your pension guarantee is not actually guaranteed.
I think that's really important, too, to see how the pension program is shifting as well, because it is supposed to be guaranteed money. You worked for it, right? You contributed to making a company successful. That's your money. And the idea that suddenly the company can say, well, we're bankrupt, so I guess you don't get your money. So you've essentially worked for free for a portion of it, which is supposedly completely illegal in the United States. I think one thing we need to talk about, too, when we talk about pensions is 401ks, because I'm sure everybody's familiar with 401ks, these retirement accounts. You put a little bit of your paycheck into them. If your company's generous, they might match them. Ks is the sort of privatization in some way of a lot of these pension funds, where the idea is, you know, there was billions and billions of dollars in pensions that investment firms wanted to get a hold of. They wanted to manage those funds because, of course, they get a percentage. They make money off of fees and other things. But they couldn't because the pension funds had certain legal protections, had certain guarantees. Investments could only be very safe, stable, kind of boring investments. And the reason was, of course, you don't want to make risky investments with someone's life savings. We want to make sure that they can retire with dignity. So you invest them in stuff that makes a little money, but not a ton of money. Like the risky stuff. And 401ks broke into the scene, and you know, lobbyists and financiers were able to push back regulations, were able to make really attractive offers to employers where they'd help them, you know, benefit tremendously financially off of these 401ks. And really it was moving these pension programs under the management of these huge wealth advisory firms, where now they're going to speculate and invest employee funds. Now, granted, there are some controls and regulations about what they can invest in. But they invest in a lot of mutual funds, a lot of stocks and bonds and things like that. And that money goes into the pockets of these large corporations and also mutual fund managers. So really, it allowed essentially the financial services industry to take a chunk of those pension plans, much more than they had before, through the process of 401ks, which is what we have now. It's essentially kind of like a, I don't know, hyper-financialized pension program. And frankly, is less stable and is less reliable than pension programs were. But like we said, with pensions vanishing, workers are going to do the best they can. And for most folks, that's a 401k program.
Yeah, the government has the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, right?
That's right, which is supposed to save everybody.
Right. So now we've talked, Daniel and John, in the past about General Electric. Like Sears, General Electric, which was considered like an anchor of American mm-hmm. business and American industry, now, you know, going through perhaps the ultimate phase, the demise of General Electric.
Yeah, its stock is less than $10 a share.
Yeah. And I want to read to you from Forbes magazine. Again, not a left-wing magazine.
Right.
It's the capitalist tool, I think.
It's as right as they come and still stay in the mainstream.
I think they brand themselves as the capitalist tool. Is it Forbes or is it Fortune? I can't remember. Anyway, here's a headline from just a little while ago. GE pensioners and stockholders contemplate the unthinkable. And I'll read a couple sentences. After the cost of insuring General Electric's debt hit a six-year high on Monday and the stock continued its precipitous decline, GE retirees began to ask about the unthinkable. I know this because I got more than 100 responses to my last article on Forbes. What would happen to their pensions if GE went bankrupt? No one is saying that a bankruptcy filing is imminent, but with few signs of a turnaround at GE, it's time to consider the worst-case scenarios. General Electric's pension plan is insured by a government agency called the Pension Benefits Guarantee Corporation, PBGC, Single Employer Plan. Here's what the PBGC says what you are guaranteed. Well, right off the bat, it should be noted that this Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation does not guarantee health benefits. So, yes, the government says we have this backstop called the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. But if these GE retirees are depending on their pension and their health care benefits are suddenly told, hey, the corporation is going to declare bankruptcy, which doesn't mean even that it won't do business. It just means it's not going to pay its debts, that it has that kind of shield or cushion through bankruptcy law. If they are left out, if they go down the list and as perhaps unsecured creditors or whatever, if they lose their pensions, this article suggests better it's time to rethink. Guess what? When you're 67, 68, 70, 75, 80 years old, you're not rethinking anything. This is what you depended on.
Brian, my grandfather worked for more than 40 years at Republic Steel in Warren, Ohio. He retired when he was 65 years old, and about 2 years into retirement, he got a letter in the mail from Republic saying, "We're sorry, the pension fund's broke. Here's $500. Good luck." And that was it. That was the end of it. It was a dark day in our house, but that happened all across America.
That's the free market, everybody. You think the free market's a great thing? It's ensconced in American governmental principles. That's the free market. The corporations can do whatever they want to.
It's really incredible when you think about it. If I default on a loan or money I'm offered to, you know, the bank, for example, I have a student loan, I can get in trouble for that, right? They can garnish my wages. They can come after me. They can take me to court. And even legislation has been passed that even if I was to declare bankruptcy, my student loan debt obligation would stay with me. It would carry with me indefinitely. So really, I could never get out from under it because I owe the bank some money. And yet, when you reverse the process, when it's a corporation that owes these people money, right? These people invested money with them. They loaned it out to them. It was the corporation's job to try to make a little money off of it, to be a caretaker of it and to keep it safe. And they didn't. Corporation just gets to write them a check and say, "Oh, sorry, we're out of money." Do I get to do that with my student loan? Do I get to write a letter to the bank and say, "Sorry, out of money, better luck next time"? No, of course not. This thing will follow me forever, and they can actually take money out of my account through legal processes. So that shows, in a simple situation, who's in charge here? Is it the workers that are making decisions? Is it the workers that are deciding how money is used and where money goes? Or is it corporations who get to decide who gets to spend it? And I think, you know, it's fairly clear. In the case that, you know, John just gave, his grandfather worked for free, right? I mean, for whatever labor he put into the company that equaled that pension, he did not get paid for. So I don't know, what is that, free labor? It sounds like slave labor to me. The idea that this person didn't get paid to work, which is exactly what happened, and that's supposedly, you know, illegal and completely abhorrent in U.S. society and legislation.
And if we look through the numbers, the CEO pay is so obscene. They just reward themselves constantly through salaries, through buybacks,
bonuses,
this, that, and the other thing. And when the company goes down, they get the golden parachute where they go out with sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars. Meanwhile, if the company declares bankruptcy, and again, the investors, the rich people who own the company are not going to lose their homes. They're taken care of. The corporation and its liabilities is what goes down. So if they can't pay the pensions that they're obligated to pay and that people are counting on, again, just think about it this way. That means they're able through this system to hand over that liability to the government through the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. It thus becomes somebody else's problem. But of course, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation itself has limited funds. In the case of GE, at the end of 2017, the portion of GE's pension plan that is insured by the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation had assets of $50.4 billion, but liabilities of $68 billion for a net underfunding of $17 billion. That's the money that the corporate bosses are able to then sort of push off. It's not their burden. It becomes the burden of the government. It becomes the burden of the taxpayer. Again, they get off scot-free.
I think that's a really important point, too, when we think about the potential conflict of interest there. If you're insured by the government, you know, what's your incentive really to manage these funds responsibly? If you know that they're going to bail you out and that taxpayers will pay it, what's the point? I mean, we could even go further and say, you know, the too big to fail banks, right? If they know they're going to get bailed out, if that is a guarantee, why would they ever behave responsibly or ethically with people's money? They can simply just, you know, gamble it and speculate on it. And if they make a whole bunch on these risky investments, great. And if they don't, well, that's okay. The taxpayers will just pay them out because we can't do without a, you know, a financial banking system, as was demonstrated in 2008. So I think that's what we see here. I understand that the insurance behind the pensions is supposed to protect working people, you know, from unforeseen events or malfeasance by a company or something like that. So I understand the goal or the aim of it, which is a progressive thing. But when you implement it in that way, when you don't hold CEOs and the people who manage those funds accountable, when they don't go bankrupt or aren't broke because they mismanaged funds or they made poor business decisions, then all you do is just create a new kind of too big to fail category, and these companies have no reason to behave ethically.
That's the voice of Daniel Sankey. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. He joins us today and every Tuesday from San Francisco in this segment of Loud and Clear called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism. Daniel, we have a, wow, time is really flying. We have a little bit more than 6 minutes. Let's go to the next story.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I want to talk about, because I think this segues nicely, is about banks behaving badly. So what has been coming out over the last couple of months is this tremendous scandal that broke with Goldman Sachs, which is one of the largest private banks in the world. And what it looks like is that some Goldman Sachs traders made a deal with the Malaysian Sovereign Wealth Fund. And sovereign wealth funds are basically funds that hold things like pensions or state money used for infrastructure or roads. It's basically taxpayer money that the state uses to fund itself as a sovereign wealth fund. And many countries invest those funds with different financial institutions to try to make money off of them, et cetera, et cetera. And Goldman Sachs positioned itself as one. Well, initially, the story started breaking that these two traders got in bed with a corrupt finance minister in Malaysia and basically created an opportunity for the minister to abscond with a large portion of funds. The traders set up a relationship with them that gave them tremendous conflict of interest and huge fees, $600 million in fees they got off of setting up this fund, which is actually way above what's normal. Most sovereign wealth funds would not accept paying that fee amount because they could go to another bank and get something cheaper. But because they were in bed together and this was a corrupt arrangement, he agreed to pay that. That was a kind of bribe or payoff for it. And initially, Goldman Sachs positioned itself as, oh, there's some rogue traders here. They're doing bad stuff. We're going to go after them. They, of course, have fled to some non-extradition country and they can't get a hold of them right now, along with the Minister of Finance. But as the story has slowly unfolded and more information has broken through, it turns out that the board of the Hong Kong entity that Goldman Sachs operates in was aware of this deal and listened to the presentation. The compliance department argued that this was not a good idea, that this seemed way too risky and problematic, decided to go ahead with it anyway, said, thanks for your input, and approved it. And so really what it shows is that this instance of corruption occurred at the extremely highest levels, the board level of Goldman Sachs, where they were aware of what was going on and thinking, well, we could probably get away with it. It should be okay. And it wasn't. I think it's really important that we have to understand it's not like this happened this one time and Wall Street Journal and others happened to catch it. If it happened this one time and we happen to know about it, it means it's happening a lot, and it's happening a lot more than just that. And this wasn't just money managed badly. This wasn't just a poor investment decision or people taking advantage of unjust laws. This was just out-and-out fraud and corruption that was something that people were aware of at the highest levels. So I think that this sort of stuff is far more common in the banking industry. Sachs is particularly bad, or at least they get caught the most because there's a number of stories of this nature. Banks, engaging in really just criminal activity and bankrupting a sovereign wealth fund in Malaysia and participating in it, which is going to cost, thousands and thousands of working people pensions, infrastructure projects are going to fall through, all sorts of other state funding is going to be short because this money has been stolen.
Daniel Sankey is our guest. Daniel, we have now 3 minutes left. What's our next story?
Okay. The next one, I think, is it was this really good write-up that they did in the Wall Street Journal on the Chinese tariffs. And it talks a lot about how the Chinese tariffs are really starting to impact American manufacturing, which you would think that's Trump's campaign promise, right? We're supposed to make American manufacturing better. But what it's talking about is how actually American manufacturing is seeing a huge increase in prices. And that's because even though they're manufacturing things here in the United States, the inputs for those things that they're manufacturing come from China. And those inputs are now much more expensive because they have to be imported. So to give you an example, if you make shoelaces and you're in a shoelace making factory in the United States, you need cotton and you can import cotton more cheaply from China, let's just say. Well, if the cotton is much more expensive, your shoelaces are going to be much more expensive. If your shoelaces are much more expensive, you're going to sell a lot less and that's going to impact your workers. You're going to probably have to start thinking about layoffs. And it's also going to impact consumers. They're going to have to start paying a lot more. I think one of the things that article makes a really good point on is this administration says that they're putting tariffs on China, as if it's China the one that's going to be punished and hurt by this. But at the end of the day, who pays for those tariffs? Who pays for that extra amount? The companies just raise their prices. So who pays those tariffs are the workers who buy those products that they need. Ultimately, these tariffs on China are really just tariffs on U.S. workers who are seeing their jobs hurt by them and also seeing an increase in prices. We knew that this would probably happen. It wasn't going to happen overnight, and a lot of economists saw it coming. But now it's starting to impact things more and more, where there are auto manufacturing here that's being hurt and all sorts of other commodities, because all their inputs that they get from China are now way more expensive than they used to be.
That's Daniel Sankey. And Daniel's right, John. A tariff is a tax on imported goods. And by the way, not just for consumer goods, but say heavy industrial goods like steel. When the United States has to pay, U.S. manufacturers pay more for imported steel, U.S. steel then doesn't, for instance, lower its steel prices. It raises them to the new price level. So U.S. steel thus gets like massive super profits because they're not paying the tax that the foreign steel companies are, but they pass along those costs to the consumer. So guess what, everybody? The tariff on foreign goods is in fact a tax on consumers, and the consumers are people like us, we the people. So when you talk about tariffs and, quote, making America great again, you're just talking about paying higher prices for goods. It's an inflationary tool, and it's not going to be that American manufacturers will lower their prices to beat up the competition. They'll raise their prices. Anyway, we are completely out of time. We were joined from San Francisco today, as we are every Tuesday, by financial policy analyst Daniel Sankey. This segment of Loud and Clear is called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.